You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 28th of April 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
I thought it would be easier. I'm a details-oriented person, I think you would say that. But I do miss my old life. I like to work, so that's not a problem. But this is actually more work.
Running the free world, surprisingly difficult. But what have the rest of us learned about President Donald Trump from his first 100 days in office? My guests Ed Stocker, Henry Reece Sheridan, Daniel Giacopelli and Marcus Hippie will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including...
So transgender, it is very odd. We're not set up to understand or see things like that.
I am a daughter, a wife. I am transgender.
The debatable appropriateness of beer companies promoting social justice, the unique vulnerability of airlines to PR disasters, and the peculiar joy of the festival that goes horribly wrong, so long as you're not there. That's all to come on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Monocle's Daniel Giacopelli, Henry Reece Sheridan and Marcus Hippie. Welcome all to the programme. Now, tomorrow will mark President Donald Trump's 100th day in office, which means two things. One, that there will only be 1,362 more days of this nonsense still to go. Two, more pertinently to today's deliberations, that it is customary on all such occasions for all news media to descend into paroxysms of beard-scratching, finger-steepling prognostication vis-a-vis what it has all meant. We are also joined for this beloved journalistic ritual by our New York Bureau Chief, Ed Stocker, who we shall turn to first. Ed, it's 100 days tomorrow, so everybody will be rolling out their big supplements then. But what do we imagine the general tone is going to be like?
Well, you know, as we've seen, it depends what media outlet you're from. If you're a friendlier one like Fox News, you're going to have much more positive things to say than if you're perhaps MSNBC or the New York Times. You know, Trump has been trying to portray, as he has done for the whole of these 100 days, a government that knows what it's doing. If you don't really believe that thing and you like to inform yourself through other means, you may be looking at a White House staff that is perhaps getting on along better now than it has done before, but is still massively divided, all with different agendas and their own PR people trying to push different types of policies. You know, we're looking at the contract with the American people that, you know, Donald Trump had as his kind of election campaign. He has failed in a number of ways. He hasn't undone Obama's Wall Street reforms. The US is still in the Paris Climate Agreement. Obama's agreement or opening up with Cuba still in place, likewise a nuclear deal with Iran, going to big legislation. You know, he hasn't managed to repeal and replace Obamacare, something he said he was going to do as the first piece of legislation he'd tried to introduce. He's flip-flopped over the military, saying he didn't really want to get involved in campaigns. Then he's, you know, dropped bombs in Syria and Afghanistan. It's a bit of a mess. I mean, he's achieved some things, one can say. He's managed to, appoint a new Supreme Court judge, Neil Gorsuch. And he's also managed to pull out the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I guess those are two of the biggest achievements. But then a lot of other areas, you can just see the mess, like I was saying, over Obamacare. We're now on Trump Care version 3.0. Voting was meant to happen perhaps now, today. It's been voted and it's been delayed until next week. And even then, it may not pass the House of Representatives. If it does pass the House, it may not pass the Senate. So that's still looking like a mess.
Danny, speaking on behalf of all 323 million Americans, which is your role here in the studio today, what have you made of his 100 days? Has he really accomplished anything? And more to the point, has he given us any reason to believe that he is going to?
He has accomplished stuff. He's actually accomplished about an average amount of things that a normal recent American president would accomplish. I mean, he hasn't accomplished anywhere near as much as FDR did. I think FDR signed 99 executive orders by this time in office. Trump signed 28, I believe. But 13 of those were rescinding Obama-era things. Two of them are renaming buildings, I believe. One of them, I forgot
what it
was.
Those buildings will not rename themselves.
Exactly.
Then.
I mean, you saw in the last couple of days Trump's team desperately scrambling to try to find accomplishments as they realized this 100 days thing was coming up, and Trump tweeted, you know, I do a lot of things and nobody gives me credit and the media, yada, yada, yada. So they tried, you know, they put forth this tax proposal in the last couple of days that's like 25 bullet points on a Word document. The Trump's team didn't even know it existed until it was happening as a kind of example of we're doing things on tax reform. What's really interesting, though, there's a piece in Vox that I've been reading from Matthew Iglesias, and he writes, actually, it depends on how you frame failure and success, because for Trump's family, making money was probably one of the goals of going to the presidency, and he's probably done a lot of it since he became president.
Well, indeed he has. Henry, looking also at the interviews he's given building up to the 100 days, and this may just be projecting my own response to them, does it feel weirdly like he's lost interest? I mean, he just sort of seems bored and annoyed by the whole thing.
Well, wasn't it the case that his interest in the actual responsibilities of the presidency, I think it was always in question, right? I think that
It's still in question.
It's still in question, right? Well, I mean, like, I think that he clearly aspired towards the station, the office, the title. I don't think that he demonstrated much interest in the actual execution of the responsibilities at all in the campaign. I don't think that he probably evaluates himself according to the same metrics by which we evaluate him and the wider media evaluate him. And I don't think he ever will. And I think he's also someone who's guided largely by his own lodestar and will continue to be. So, you know, I can't imagine him ever conceding defeat or even tinging his own performance in a negative light.
I'm trying to draw my own conclusions on his management skills and on his personality when it comes to being a leader. It looks like he's quite impatient, obviously. He promised a lot. He's been trying to do a fair amount of things, but it seems to be a reoccurring pattern that he doesn't realize that when he gives commands, it's not realistic to actually get them through. Just look at that recent travel ban, for example, for a handful of countries, mostly from Muslim nations. It didn't go through. It couldn't work. It was turned down. That's just one example of things he wanted to get done really quickly with no success. And now that he realizes that actually he's not going to be quite as powerful as he thought, he's losing interest.
To come back to you, Ed, how perplexed has the American media been by those interviews? The detail that struck me from the interview he did with Reuters was that he met with three journalists and he'd had maps of his Electoral College win prepared for all of them, as if we were not all, thanks mostly to him by now, able to recite the results from memory.
Yeah, except, you know, he often gets it wrong about the significance of his Electoral College victory. But, you know, we know that Donald Trump is all about him, let's be honest, and he likes to fall back on the fact that he is a so-called winner. I think just to kind of go back to the point everyone in the studio was making about the fact that he perhaps isn't really that bothered about the details. And, you know, there's a piece in Politico about him not really liking to be briefed in the traditional way that presidents are, which is normally a fairly detailed PowerPoint presentation. He's more interested in having it broken down in the pros, the cons, and how it's going to play with the media. We have this kind of odd situation that he loves to rile against the media, and yet he's kind of obsessed with it. This is a TV president who consumes Fox and Friends, who likes to still read the New York Post every morning, who cares deeply about what these media are saying about him, and apparently, according to many reports, kind of sets his daily agenda based on what they are saying and not vice versa.
Ed, thank you for joining us. President Donald Trump is not the only person in the world who has recently found themselves doing a job which is more difficult than they imagined it might be. Spare a thought for the public relations department at United Airlines, whose wait for a change of luck is continuing. Having reached an undisclosed but doubtless expensive settlement with the passenger unceremoniously evicted from a flight earlier this month, United have also had to deal with the death of a giant rabbit. I'm not laughing, it isn't funny. Shortly after deplaning from a transatlantic flight. Marcus, first of all, the latest policy they have announced is that they will give up now up to $10,000 in travel vouchers for people who give up their seat after being overbooked. What do you make of this?
It's not going to rescue the situation. I wish they had had that policy already earlier. That way they probably would not have needed to drag this poor man out of the plane, so that he lost two teeth, for example. I think what Delta is facing now is quite hard
United.
To go...
United.
Sorry, United. I think it's quite hard to go back from this situation now. I don't think this death of the giant rabbit, for example, would have made news had we not paid so much attention to the poor airline company already. I guess when they get to that vicious circle, all bad news gets so much more attention than they would otherwise.
Danny, again, speaking on behalf of your entire people, it is a question I want to put to you because it has come up a lot in the wake of this debacle, which is an extreme example of the dysfunction of American carriers, by which I don't mean American airlines, except to the extent that I kind of do, because I'm talking about American carriers. But there is a massive difference between flying internally in the United States, which I have done many times, as I'm sure you have, and flying internally within Europe, as I did as recently as yesterday. One is flying in Europe's usually all right. It's, you know, it's not as perhaps as luxurious or as formal as it once was, but it's okay.
Yeah.
Whereas traveling domestically in the US is hideous.
It's because when the price of fuel plummeted and European carriers were able to offer like £10 flights to Barcelona or whatever, it didn't happen concurrently in the US. So the prices really didn't drop within the US. So you have hugely expensive airlines flight tickets in the US, and here in Europe you have cheap ones. And also the service is just crappier. And I don't know why it is. They're more expensive, they're crappier, less efficient.
Because in almost every other walk of life, service in America is an infinitesimally better than it is most places in Europe. It's just on aeroplanes.
Sure.
It's awful.
Yeah, it is. It is awful, and I don't know why. But I do know that when I was coming back from New York to London a couple of weeks ago, of course, on my airline, they overbooked the flight. And they were offering seats, and first they started at 1,000. They said, anybody want to get off the plane for 1,000? And obviously I'm thinking about it. And then they bumped it up to 1,500, and you see like whispers in the plane. And a couple people actually took up their offer.
Is there a dynamic of kind of brinkmanship these offers start
I mean,
to be?
Well, yeah, because, chicken, because I, yeah, I think the $10,000 which Delta have matched, I mean, it's a PR
but
stunt
also,
in itself. Someone will always buckle for less than that. I would.
But the key words there, which nobody's really pointing out, are up to 10,000.
Well, exactly.
What does that mean?
It means up
500?
To...
500? I mean, you know.
Well, I think it means the first number at which somebody puts their hand up and goes, all right, I'm off.
So it's an auction.
It's a bizarre auction, isn't it?
It's as Henry said, we will get these weird Dutch auctions now on you know, in departure lounges as everybody wants the price to go up, but
also,
doesn't want to miss it.
We also need to point out a few details about the bunny, which is seemingly gone unnoticed in the media. First of all, he didn't die on the plane. He died in the cargo hold area after he got off the plane.
I did mention that.
Waiting for a connecting flight, but that's not really reported. Also, and this is kind of genius, he's the son, the Simon the rabbit, is the son of the world's largest bunny, whose name is Darius. So it's Simon, son of Darius. And he could have surpassed his father's size, says this one article, if he lived.
We may never know.
A giant rabbit.
And we're not poking fun, it's just sad.
Marcus, do you think United will be damaged in the long run, say a year, 2 years, by this, or will ultimately passengers just revert to going to wherever they can get the cheapest fare?
I think it's going to be really interesting to see. I've been wondering why United has been getting so much bad rep for this. Obviously, we're talking about an awful case. It was a prime example of public relations done wrong in the beginning when they just wouldn't apologise. But then again, I think it's this case is getting so much attention because, in a way, airline carriers still have a certain promise of luxury, what they used to represent before. Not anymore. This is one example of that massive decline we've been witnessing in the last, I don't know, 30 years maybe. At the same time, I think it's easy to laugh at airline companies because they are internationally known brands and they do represent a class hierarchy in a way, because this frustration probably mostly comes from those who are traveling coach class or economy class.
Not like you, Marcus.
Because if you fly business class, if you fly first class, the experience is going to be very different, and those passengers probably won't be talking about how it's all got so bad recently.
Henry, do you think, are we too hard on airlines? Are they, because of the position they occupy, uniquely susceptible to online monstering when something goes wrong?
What do you mean? What do you mean according to the positions that they occupy?
Well, because they are, as Marcus points out, they're global brands. Everybody relies on them, and by and large, when air passengers are inconvenienced, they're likely to be more annoyed than you would be if you'd just gone to the shop and bought something that was somehow unsatisfactory. You might be stranded thousands of kilometers from home with no luggage.
I mean, yeah, exactly. I mean, when things go wrong on an aeroplane, it tends to be really shit in the way that, you know, things going wrong in other areas of service don't. It tends to result in either death.
Can you imagine if your coach was overbooked? You were on your way to Wales, it was overbooked, and then you were dragged out of
the bus. I hope this is a hypothetical scenario.
Would that make international headlines?
Also, I mean, two things that we've missed also here is United has also adopted this no questions asked policy. If they lose your baggage permanently, and they'll give you $1,500 if they lose your baggage.
That's a good deal. I don't think I've ever traveled with $1,500 worth of stuff in my life.
Exactly. And also, if you're seated on one of their planes now, you won't be required to get up if it's overbooked. So what happened to David Dow will not happen again. They can't make you get up.
Before we go to a break, just a quick round the table. I'll start with you, Henry, and then we will proceed counterclockwise. Are you any more or less likely to fly with United Airlines than you were a month ago?
I am not less likely. I will chase the lowest fare at almost any cost.
Marcus?
I reckon I will make my decision basing on the flight times and the price.
Danny?
Is this ignoring the United Airlines tattoo I have on my forehead? United Airlines, the choice for you.
We are going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Daniel Giacopelli, Henry Rhys Sheridan, and Marcus Hippie. Do stay tuned.
Pack your bags and join us on a global tour through exciting and inspiring cities. From Madrid to Miami, Tokyo to Toronto, we've created travel guides that will help you get the best out of a city, no matter how short your stay. We'll whirl you around some of our favorite architectural spots, top cultural haunts, and then point you in the direction of a well-earned drink from a little-known cocktail bar. We've also scouted the prettiest running routes, the most design-savvy shops, and the best hotels to comfortably rest your head. View our full range of travel guides at monocle.com or visit any good bookstore and plan your next escape today. Cities are fun. Let's explore.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Daniel Giacopelli, Henry Rhys Sheridan, and Marcus Hippie. Now, as we have been discussing, the least that one can hope from a company enduring a PR disaster is that it learns something from the experience, because if they don't, their rivals might. Witness the recent clangor by Pepsi, which sought to co-opt modern protest movements in a woefully misjudged and hastily withdrawn campaign. They have been rather upstaged by Heineken, whose new campaign approaches political difference rather more wittily, bringing together political opponents under false pretenses before inviting them to discuss their differences over a drink. Here's some of it.
Feminism today is definitely an excuse for misandry, man-hating.
If somebody said to me that climate change is destroying the world, then I'd say that is total piffle.
So transgender, it is very odd. We're not set up to understand or see things like that.
I am a daughter, a wife. I am transgender.
I feel like the battle for feminism definitely isn't done. The fight is never going to be over, if I'm honest with you.
You now have a choice. You may go, or you can stay and discuss your differences over a beer.
Well, I'm having a drink.
I'm having a drink.
Yeah.
I want to discuss.
Beer.
Yeah, beer and discuss.
The new Heineken ad there, which is all terrifically heartwarming, and it is clever and it is wittily done. They have invited people who are political opposites to take part in what they are initially told is a social experiment, and at the end there's the big reveal and you get to decide whether you want to stay and have a beer with this person or not. Danny, the first thing that struck me was everyone loves this. It's getting a fantastic response online. It would be regarded completely the opposite if a cigarette manufacturer did it, though. What's the difference?
Because everybody loves going to the pub and drinking over some issues with friends. That's a thing.
But quite a lot of people enjoy smoking as well.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, smoking's entered the territory of things that are generally bad for you. Whereas even though drinking is bad for you, it's still kind of a ha-ha thing you can joke about. The thing that I found most interesting about the ad was that it didn't necessarily bring both sides together in terms of like understanding each other. What it did was it brought people who had more right-wing views to understand the left-wing people better. Like the person who hate feminists didn't say, or rather the, you know, the person who you know, was a feminist didn't say, oh, I understand your bigotry now. You know what I mean? It was a kind of a one-way thing.
It's almost as if the bigots and cranks are wrong, Danny.
Well, exactly. But that's why it's kind of interesting as an ad. They're kind of taking sides on these
Marcus,
issues.
Marcus, a beer company is an engine of social justice. Are we buying it?
I'd like to correct you a little bit. Not everyone loved it. I didn't like it. I found it rather irritating.
Okay.
I saw it a bit differently. I saw that you had people doing things for liberal rights being basically put in this uncomfortable situation of having to speak to people who don't understand their values at all or even question their presence, as in the case of this transgender individual who was made to face someone who says that men should be men and women should be women and that's their place. I think it was nasty, and I don't understand why we have brands such as this trying to bring themselves out to the public as if they would offer some kind of solutions in these kind of deep problems. If they have that one bottle of Heineken, they're not going to find understanding on climate change.
I think there is a callback here to the famous Coca-Cola campaign of the early 70s, the I'd like to buy the world a Coke thing, the idea that a carbonated beverage could be a lubricant of social harmony. Henry, are you buying it?
I'm not. I have a knee-jerk squeamishness towards this advert, which, like most of my views, is both strongly held and vaguely formulated. I mean, a few things about the advert. I don't think we have kind of elucidated the conceit, which is a bit bizarre behind the advert, right? Which is that, like, these two strangers are ushered into a bizarre kind of holding warehouse where they're presented with some IKEA furniture, which makes a bar that they're asked to assemble.
It may not be IKEA, we should probably point out. It is flat-packed.
Other flat-packed brands of furniture are available.
And it is, of course, rare that working on flat-packed furniture actually gets two people to get on better than they previously did.
Right, but I think we can assume that it's meant to be some kind of tortured metaphor for cooperation, right? And I don't like that because I think it's a crap idea. And then I don't like adverts which purport to have real people as their subjects, because it always feels not quite real. You know that they've interviewed thousands and thousands of people to cast this advert. You know.
How many of them ended up in fistfights, you wonder?
That's what they didn't show. I'd like to see
the blooper reel would be something to see, wouldn't it?
And there's something particularly cynical about ostensibly presenting genuine human interactions to sell a consumer product, which aren't. And I think, you know, there are so many examples now. I think one of the most famous ones was that Dove Real Women Real Bodies, you know, advert that came out a few years ago. Of course, they're all, you know, plus-size models, you know, the people that were on there. There's something distasteful about that for me.
Well, finally tonight, however, to a story from the It Would Take a Heart of Stone Not to Laugh Out Loud file. Fire Festival, that's F-Y-R-E Festival, ostensibly a luxury wingding in the Bahamas and priced accordingly, appears to have fallen some way short of the advertising, which is to say that it has not furnished those who spent in the vicinity of $12,000 on a ticket with the promise of a cultural moment created from music, art and food close quote, but has provided those who couldn't afford to go with a great deal of amusement at the outraged reports of ramshackle accommodation, inedible food and general disorganisation. It hasn't all been bad news for the festival's attendees, though. Blink 182 did cancel. Danny, why...
As someone who liked them when I was in high school, I take offence.
Why is everyone finding these reports from Fire Festival so amusing?
Because
everybody
funny
is.
Funny making fun of rich hipsters who go to an island expecting magical moments and ending up in, like, tents eating cheese on bread. It's just, everything about it's hilarious. And the victims are not people to be mourned. They're rich kids, so you're giving free rein to make fun of them.
I mean, I'm enjoying this because, in the way that I think we all enjoy news reports or reports of events that, you know, reinforce our own view of the world, and my own view of the world is that all festivals are terrible. So this one has demonstrated the drawbacks of them as events. Marcus, have you ever been to an especially terrible festival? Because I think... I think unless you have been to one, and I have been to many, you can't really know what horrors they can descend into.
That's really true. I've been to quite a few of them. I used to work as a TV reporter in Finland some years ago, and one of the regular gigs I had to do was to go to this heavy metal festival in Helsinki. It was called Tuska, which stands for pain, and that quite well explained how I felt over there when I had to be reporting the whole day about what the heavy metal fans
are
up to over
there.
Yeah,
but that's just a day, though. You could go home afterwards.
I know, and that was the best thing. There would have been no way I would have done it if I should have stayed in a tent.
But you really wonder what happened here. I mean, they must have made many, 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 many hundreds of thousands of pounds from tickets, if not more. And they got there, and there are these white tents. There's no food. There's nothing. I mean, it was just like the whole thing was a total scam. And this was, I mean, they had some big, you know, high rollers like bankrolling this thing and organizing it.
It does, for all my sneering at the idea of festivals, it does remind us that the actually successful on its own merits festival is an extraordinary logistical enterprise to get all that stuff set up, all that catering for that many people. It's clearly very easy to do it badly. Henry, have you ever been to an absolute shocker of a festival?
I've been to very few festivals. I just want to state for the record that I refuse on principle to extend any sympathy to any human being that befalls any degree of misfortune.
Full stop.
From from voluntarily opting in to a phenomenon that can be described as the brainchild of Ja Rule.
Well, there is that, but that's going to sound so much better when we crop it. Yeah. So it just sort of says, I refuse to ever to extend any sympathy to any human being ever.
I just put it at the top of the show, any other comments.
I think we'll drop that into all our promos from now on.
I avoid festivals as far as I possibly can. I did go to a terrible festival, a one-day festival in London last year because one act that I wanted to go and see...
Blink 182.
It was Blink 182.
In an ironic twist.
Were headlining, and I have to say I came away still ambivalent. Was it worth it? Was it worth putting up with the general ambient idiocy of that context?
It's never ever worth it. I mean, and the thing is as well, you know, anybody can, you can recreate the festival experience in your own garden anytime you like by just turning the hoses on it for about 3 days beforehand, putting lots and lots of terrible, terrible music on a stereo right down at the far end of the garden so you can't actually hear anything, and then inviting round hundreds of people you can't stand.
Most weekends in your house, I've heard.
Exactly.
Then again, we might all just be cynical old white men who, you know, don't like these such things.
I'm a cynical young white man. I'd like to...
Marcus,
I mean, some festivals can be fun. Festivals where you're sloshing around in mud and, pissing on the side of a road and getting, you know, attacked by drunk people on acid, and those aren't fun. But, well, maybe they are fun.
Have you ever been to one you've liked, Marcus? We've got a few seconds left. Say something nice about a festival.
I think a festival can be a nice experience if you can leave whenever you want to and you can go home and sleep at your home.
Your ideal festival is one you don't go to.
Or you can just go there for one gig and escape straight after.
I think we can all agree on that. Marcus Hippy, Danny Giacopelli and Henry Rhys Sheridan, thank you for joining us here at Midori House. That is all we have time for. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Helena Jarit. Our studio manager was George McDonough. More music next at 1900. Marcus is back with The Menu. I'm back with more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns on Monday at the same time. That's 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Miller. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.